spent 20 years covering Formula One and now has a book published by Penguin. Access to the Paddock, the Garage, and the people who make the sport run, Australian journalist Stuart Bell has been telling Formula One story from the inside for over two decades. And he's got a lot to say. We had a brilliant chat. Welcome back to Away We Go podcast. Are you ready?
It's lights out and away we go.
Welcome back to Away We Go podcast, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel and lifestyle surrounding the sport. My name's Diane Bortoletto and today I'm in Margaret River and I've got a great episode for you guys today. I'm joined by a very esteemed and established veteran Formula One journalist, Stuart Bell, who's covered the sport for more than 20 years and he's just authored a book about Formula One called Formula One, the World's Most Brutal Sport. So welcome to the show, Stuart.
Thank you very much.
Oh, so good to have you here. And where in the world can we find you?
I'm in Melbourne, so home of the Australian Grand Prix, and this is my home base. I produce a weekly TV show here, so that keeps me here a lot of the year, but just, yeah, true, the races I want to go to, and yeah, it's a great base to live in and work from.
Yeah, great. When was the first time you covered a Formula One race? Can you remember?
Yeah, that was 2007, the Australian Grand Prix. I was, very green. It was 10 years after I'd gone to the first Grand Prix. In 97 was the first time I went to a race. And I was just blown away by the V10 engines, the presentation of the cars, Albert Park circuit, or just everything about it, the international atmosphere. It was just intoxicating. Yeah, basically, I had no links to the sport. I had no links to racing or journalism or anything like that. And just basically pitched my way in. Well, I lived in Japan in 2004 and went to the Japanese Grand Prix then and just started writing. And then, basically through a whole lot of mentors, whether it be like Steve Cooper, who was at F1 Racing Magazine, he's now at Aston Martin, or guys like Mark Harding, more recent mentor, who's one of the Australia's greatest sports journalists. My ambition's always been way in excess of my talent. So to close that up, you really need the skills and the people to show you the ropes. And so I've been really lucky to have some amazing people just show me standard that's expected. And I built it from there. It's just been a lot of pitching and then moving into publishing and went to News Corp to do the official program of the Grand Prix. So I was editor of that. And then, just onwards and upwards from there. So I've been very lucky, but still working as hard as ever.
Yeah, 20 years on. Gosh. And what's your favourite thing about working in Formula One?
I love the immediacy of it. When you send a request to the teams, you get a response almost overnight. And deadlines are short. I really enjoy the sort of the press-up element that comes with it. That's part of being the best you can be. That it really forces you to deliver under maximum pressure. I love that. The people at the core of the sport are really lovely. You're not always speaking with the drivers and the team bosses. You're dealing with a lot of people who make the cogs in the overall machines. At the heart of Formula One is a group of fantastic people, and that they're great to work with. They're efficient in their jobs. They're lovely people. And it's a combination of delivering under pressure, the immediacy of it, the forward thinking. That's something you're always looking forward to, the next story, the next big thing, the next big event. So it's a really great sport to live your life by because it's just 24/7.
Yeah. And there's, now the calendar's so long, like there's so many races now, thanks to the booming popularity of Formula One and so many host nations wanting a race or host cities wanting a race for, all the marketing and economic benefits that come from, hosting such a behemoth event. There's not too many events in the world that attract, just look at the Melbourne Grand Prix, close to 500,000 spectators over 4 days. I mean, there's not too many sports that can sort of boast those numbers. It's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. And just seeing people coming in, the young generation now, seeing groups of young boys and girls coming in, it's awesome. It just really fills my heart with joy to see people enjoying the sport and to see the Grand Prix circuit. It really is at its high watermark. You see all of the hospitality enclosures, more things to see and do at the circuit than ever before. And people knowing about the sport. I remember when I first started, people really, people would say, oh, Schumacher was still winning when he was long retired. People really didn't have a very deep understanding of F1. And now they're asking, why did that happen? Or they have an opinion on the latest story. And it's just turned full circle. To be part of it at this point and to be established and to be able to inform is just a joy.
And have you noticed like a difference, like since the Drive to Survive boom of the sport, like has your access to, you know, drivers and team personnel, has that been restricted because there's just more requests from all angles coming in at the teams?
Not really. I think I know what they're going to pick up on. So I think I don't go to them with small requests. I go to them with a number of requests. I might compound a request. I might say, I've got these three outlets that are wanting coverage. Can we do something for all three and then cover all three off at the one time? So yeah, there's certainly more influencers doing things in the paddock, and you definitely see all the guys and gals from TikTok who have huge followings and should be exploiting all that sort of stuff. You see them at the circuit in the paddock. And so it's all happening in the digital space, but still there's a place for sports coverage. And yeah, I think it's just about us maximizing our coverage and our opportunities. But yeah, it's definitely different to the journalists that we would see in the paddock who were just hardcore racing guys. I mean, that was it.
Definitely. So then as I guess the interest was growing and media outlets want more stories about F1. Yeah, because I remember when I worked in London in 2002 in the late 90s on a Formula One account, the brief was to get the sport, we'll get stories out of sport and into general news and into lifestyle sections of media, right, which was at that time a real challenge because, Michael Schumacher was winning everything back then. The team, the Orange Arrows that we represented, were not. So it was a tough ask, yeah.
Of course, you were trailblazing lifestyle coverage for Formula One. So that's amazing. That is incredible that you're selling stories where there's a very well-trodden path for that sort of stuff now.
Yeah.
You did the hard yards in trying to convince the lifestyle that Formula One was relevant. That's amazing.
It was a tough ask, but we did get some wins on the board, which was good. Now, tell us a little bit about your time working with Daniel Ricciardo. You know, he's someone that we all miss in the paddock, and just the way he left was just heartbreaking, that last interview that he did. Yeah, tell us about your experience working with him.
He blasted onto the scene as he was going through like Formula BMW Europe, and then he came into Formula One via HRT. And yeah, I was there from the start. And at that stage, he was very fresh-faced, very earnest and wanting to make a good impression. And I remember I was the only media in the garage for his first run at Albert Park with Toro Rosso as a test driver. It was his parents and I. And it was just amazing to see him getting his shot. And he was, we did a long interview after that. As he became more comfortable and as he grew through the sport, his confidence rose. But he's always been the same guy. He's always been that just lovely guy. Very honest. He likes to have a laugh. He's the guy next door, but he levels with you when you have a chat with him, especially when you're trusted. It was difficult, obviously, seeing him. He left Red Bull at the end of 2018. And I think, there's many factors there. Obviously, the rise of Max Verstappen, he wasn't happy about the Azerbaijan crash that they had. And Honda at that point was unproven. They'd been with McLaren. So he went to Renault, which they loved him. They put him on a big money deal and they really loved him. Maybe he saw that they weren't putting the full effort in to move towards the front and then move to McLaren. And that's really where I saw him change, because he went from this very relaxed, positive guy under massive pressure. And he was just, I wouldn't say frightened, but he was just like, almost like he was one loss away from it all closing in on him. You could see that he just felt, if I just work a little bit harder, I can crack this car. But, speaking with members of McLaren after that, they really said the team loved him, but him and the car were like oil and water. His style just didn't match the car. And so when he left, obviously, he was just absolutely, it was a body blow to be released from McLaren. But when he went and took the third driver role on at Red Bull, and I chatted with him in the paddock in Melbourne, and it was like the old Daniel Ricciardo would return. And he was really happy to be back at a top team, to not have the pressure put on him. And obviously he went on to take the drive at RB to Racing Bulls, and it ended the way he did. But I think if he had ended his career off in McLaren, it would have been a lot worse. He got at least a chance to come off that McLaren bull ride and come back. But still, to be jettisoned after Singapore was tough.
I really thought that just with his gregarious personality and how well loved he is throughout the paddock and with fans, I really thought we'd see him on the broadcasting side potentially, like Nico Rosberg, or, you know, offering some insight as a former Formula One driver. But no, what's he doing for performance racing and in the States? So
I think he's still got a little bit of debriefing to do within himself, maybe a bit of soul searching. We saw that interview with him and Jim Farley, the CEO of Ford, recently. And I think he'd come to terms with the fact that he just didn't have that sort of final 10th in him to challenge, to be consistent and to fight for results that he believed he was capable of. I've put in requests with Blake, his manager, and I think, and with Ford, and I just think he needs time to decompress a little bit and realize that he had a fantastic career. His last win at Monza in 2021 was a fantastic final win for him. Yeah.
Yeah, great. And Zach's got a permanent reminder of that, hasn't he, on his the tattoo of the circuit?
Yeah.
Fantastic. So going from somebody like Daniel Ricciardo, who's very full of life, wears his heart on his sleeve, to someone like Kimi Räikkönen, who you've also worked with. Tell us about that experience.
Wow. It's just, you couldn't be more like chalk and cheese, really, could you, Kimi Räikkönen? He's a quiet talker. He really doesn't give much. His answers are very short. And he does that to ward away journalists who want features with him, who want interviews with him. The funniest experience is when it was 2013, I think it was, GQ India asked me for this sort of, it was something around the Belgian Grand Prix. Obviously, he had a lot of success around there. I think 4 wins for a number of teams. And they wanted to do this lifestyle feature where it was like, where does he go to eat? Where does he stay? Like a women's weekly sort of expose on what he's doing. And I was just like, this is never going to work in a month of Sundays. So I went to Andy Stobart, who was at, I think he was at Lotus at the time, and just said, look, this is what they want. And so Andy gave me the sheet of answers. They'd created a list of every Kimi lifestyle answer you can imagine, everything including his favorite ice cream flavor and all that sort of stuff. I did an interview with Kimi, and really, you've just got to speak about sporty stuff in the car and try to make the best with him and have a load of questions. You know, it's the same with Bernie. You need to be armed with a load of questions. It's different to speaking with someone like Nico Rosberg or David Coulthard, where they just, you give them a talking point and they'll just go on and on. But yeah, Kimi, you've got to just, understand where when he's going to stop short and throw another one at him and use as much as you can within the 10 minutes you're allocated, really.
Gosh, 10 minutes, it's not long, is it, to try and build especially if you don't know them, try and build a bit of a rapport, try to establish a bit of trust. And yeah, it's not a long time to get what you need to write 2,000 words or whatever it is you've got to write.
That's it, especially if you've stacked outlets to the same amount of time. I found that, especially when trying to make a living from Australia, obviously doing a lot of work here, it doesn't allow for rapport. It's very rare that you will, unless you're speaking with someone who you've spoken with over and over again, when you can just say, g'day, how's it going? And just start off nicely. But yeah, I think in that world, 10 minutes is just, you've got 10 questions. I think I normally plan for about 15. You've just got to get through it. And yeah.
And you haven't just worked as a journalist in Formula One. You've also been like a press officer. So tell us a little bit about like where you've worked and what you've done there.
I've worked with Singapore. It helped them with media coverage in terms of, I mean, Australia is their biggest ticket seller, helping them build their brand and bring journalists across to do Formula trips. I've done VIP media tours there and really give people who, I mean, just as you were doing, bringing people in who don't have a clue about Formula One, giving them some information, facilitating all that sort of stuff for them and making it as easy as possible for them to have a good time and a positive experience at the event. But yeah, seeing Singapore developed since it came onto the scene has been just in leaps and bounds the way that they've developed that event. I've also done work and a few others. I just really enjoy the strategic element of the business. I've written so many words. It's for the journalistic side. I think in 2018, when I was writing at the height of my writing career, I would have done 8 to 9 out of 10 F1 features in Australia. So it was a lot of work. And essentially, you're either writing, this guy is good, this guy is bad, this guy came fifth, this guy came sixth. So there has to be more to it. So that's why I enjoy doing editing programs and producing of TV, because there's just a lot more challenge in it. And same goes with the PR side. Yeah, so there's challenges in all of those parts of the biz.
From writing words in media outlets, to writing a book, Formula One, the world's most brutal sport. Tell us about the book and the writing process, and how did you find time to even sit down and write the book?
That's a story in itself, and I'll tell you that next. But first, look, F1 is at such a high watermark at the moment, the glamour. Most people go to the track, have a great time just as they should, and they see the drivers on board very smooth, and it all looks very sort of relaxed. But behind the drivers and behind the people in Formula One, there is a very intense pressure environment, and everyone is pushing to their limits, working long hours. And I think it was certainly time for a bit, not a time for a dose of reality, but I think it just putting people actually in the paddock at the beating heart of the sport will give them a different perspective on what Formula One's really like. So that was the motivation for it. Penguin started working with them and they wanted me to pitch some ideas, and that was the idea. It was a very pressured deadline. So it started in May and it required 5,000 words a week, every week, for 4 straight months.
Wow. That's a lot. I have written a manuscript years ago and I pitched it out to publishers. And at the time they said, not really what we're looking for. It doesn't fit with our marketing. And then I decided that writing it was what I needed to do. I didn't need the whole world to read it. So I've kind of just put it in a drawer and I'm very happy with that. But 5,000 words a week, like I would be patting myself on the back if I got to 3,000 a week. I can appreciate that's a lot.
Yeah. And that was on top of a full-time job.
Yeah.
So I was producing the inside line. And I've got a family, so I don't want to be stuck in the bedroom writing during the weekend. So I was fitting that in from Monday to Friday. And so I had two laptops. One was with my archive of interviews, and then the other one I was writing it. But some chapters were harder than others, especially in terms of the business ones, just getting things right and getting things succinct. And that was the exhausting part, was I treated it like an article of 400 words. I really didn't cut corners. And it was my first book, and anything that I've done for the first time and on an ongoing basis, but especially the first time, I want to absolutely nail it. So I really agonized over the words, and it required absolute dedication. And it's not for the faint-hearted. You know what it's like. You really got to knuckle down and deliver. But yeah, there's no other option. Once they set the deadline, you're set. You're blasting off.
Exactly. What can readers expect in the book? Because it's written in two halves. Is that right?
It is. So the first half is all about the driver's life cycle, what it takes from, being bitten by the racing bug as a kid, all the way through to what it takes financially to go up through the ranks. Costs about $8 million, or between $16 million perhaps, would be about if you're not affiliated with an F1 academy. So it's not cheap, and it goes through establishing yourself once you've got the drive, and it's filled with exclusive quotes from my career at every part. It's about hearing from the drivers and the teams that are involved. And the second half is really about the teams and mechanics, engineers, the business of F1, the governance of F1, technical sort of advantages and whatnot, scandals. But it's really, I wanted this to be a reference book. I didn't want to just write a book. I want someone to, if they love Drive to Survive and they think, I actually want to go deeper on this, they grab the book and they will know exactly, they'll understand the sport in just that short reading. And from not a tired old rehashing of things, I want it to be a really passionate telling of what Formula One's all about. It's a very real way. Yeah, that was my motivation. And so all the way through, I really wanted to make sure that, it was true to my original vision and that it's full of energy. I wanted just to grab the reader from the first page and just finally let go of them on the last. And that, I think, obviously reread it and reread it in proofreading, and I'm happy with it. I think that's the most important thing, is I'm happy with it. And what people it's been resonating with people who read it. And look, that's just the icing on the cake for me. So I really appreciate everyone's support.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I can't wait to read it. And it's out now and you can get it on Amazon and a bunch of other places where good books are sold. I'll put a link in the show notes to that so you guys can get a copy of Formula One, The World's Most Brutal Sport by Stuart Bell. Now, in your F1 career, then, Stuart, like, have you had any kind of pinch me moments, like moments where you're like, I can't believe I'm standing here. I can't believe I'm here talking to this person. Has there been any times like that where you've just been, gosh?
the person that comes to mind is Alain Prost. To be sitting next to him, hearing from him, talking about different elements of the sport team building, which is that he spoke about, he was then with Renault and, speaking about how to build teams and his thoughts on where Formula One should be going, which was fascinating hearing from him. For the Australian Grand Prix just passed, I was ensconced with the Haas team. So I was in their garage for FP2. And I think you can never really shed that excitement of being in a Formula One garage. It is absolutely the best of the best experience to see the mechanics, the engineers rallying around. And with the headphones on, you can hear how calm everyone is. But you really see the beating heart of the sport. Whether it's there or speaking with the drivers, it's always a thrill, and it just makes you remember, this is why I'm doing this, is to tell the stories of these great drivers. So at the end of the day, seeing them out on track is just, it's great chatting with them. It's great being in the garage. But when you see them out on track, it's being at the British Grand Prix and being at Magnussen Beckett's and watching Hamilton out in the wet, going through those curves, or being in Brazil. I think that's my favorite race of all time, and seeing them fly through the center S, it is just magical. Yeah, it's those sort of experiences that just fill my boots.
Oh, fantastic. And you've also had an experience with Ayrton Senna.
Well, with his press officer. I was doing a feature with her and her relationship, obviously working relationship with Ayrton Senna. And she was fascinating. But the most chilling tale, as she said, was obviously the day that he passed, the 1st of May 1994, and talking me through what that was like to her and her team. It just, you can't believe it. She was at the hospital trying to keep the media away from his brother, and Gerhard Berger came in and wanted to view Senna and came out white as a ghost. And it's just that I'm like a student of the sport, and I read voraciously on everything, and I've never heard anything like what she'd said to that sort of behind the scenes detail of arguably the greatest Grand Prix driver of all times passing. And that's in the book. I mean, that's when things go wrong, and you know how dangerous it can be. And but to have insight into that, for her to share that with me, I just feel so honored that she did. But she's a fantastic person that's been in the PR game for a long time. But on the lighter side, just hearing things like journalists would ask Senna what his favorite color was, and that sort of, he didn't find that very funny. He's an intense guy. But just that was the side of the sport that just, when you speak to people like that with that sort of long history in the sport and the level of detail that you can hear, the resolution of the stories is just, it's mind-blowing. And that, but that's a particularly chilling account of that fateful day.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, we've said lots of times on this podcast in the past that the safety of Formula One has increased so much in recent times, which is just fantastic. I mean, I often think about Roman Grosjean's accident and how he walked away and how he's now back racing, like not in Formula One, in a different code of motorsport, but phenomenal, just absolutely phenomenal. And had that accident happened 10 years earlier, like he wouldn't be here to tell the tale, I'm sure of it. So and speaking of changes of the sport, there's a lot of chatter online, I'm sure you're aware of it, about, you know, the battery championships, etc., with this new regulation of the new era we're in with Formula One. I mean, what's your view about it?
I think we're seeing the racing, it looked quite a little bit artificial in Melbourne. China was a lot better, and we saw some pretty good racing in Japan, but I think the qualifying element of it, we want to see these drivers at the absolute limit. We want to see them attacking corners, and that's not what we have at the moment. Now, obviously, the FIA and Formula One, the teams having meetings at the moment to try and tweak the rules. The best idea would be to boost the amount of output from the engine rather than trying to, you can tweak, obviously, the energy side of it, but also I think that's it's not likely to happen, but that's probably what needs to be done. But I think it's been good seeing Ferrari and then McLaren challenging the Mercedes off the line to have good racing up the front. But there's no doubt it needs to be tweaked, and definitely in qualifying, where we need to see these guys flat out low fuel. It has to be man and machine at the absolute limit, and that should be our North Star at all times.
Yeah, good point. I mean, I have found the racing exciting, the racing itself. I like overtakes. I don't really like watching races where one driver gets in the front and you know exactly what's going to happen for the next 51 laps. I find it a bit boring. I like the change in leadership. And I like that, you know, so there's more teams at the pointy end of the front that are challenging, I guess. But yeah, it was Ollie Bearman's accident that really, I suppose, brought the point home of all the negative chatter that you see online about these new regs. Like, okay, all right, this is not cool. Like, cars cannot be super clipping and then someone coming around a corner 50 k's faster than the car in front. It's just a matter of time before there's something really, really awful that happens. And that accident with Ollie Bearman was bad enough. So, yeah, let's hope that the FIA come up with a solution. So I haven't heard anything. Have you heard anything?
It's all about harvesting and whether they'll be able to harvest as much or quicker harvesting so that they're not down on power for as long. But looking in Japan and the fact that Lando Norris said his battery just deployed and he was forced to overtake Lewis Hamilton. So we don't want to be seeing that sort of artificial behavior, and we don't want to see it, especially in qualifying. It's tough because the FIA can force things through on safety grounds, but we really need the teams in the sport to work together to make sure that it is these drivers pushing to overtake one another in a competitive manner rather than, who's deploying when.
Yeah, and like the drivers being in control of the car as well. Even the rear wings when they open with boost mode and with the rear wings opening, like my understanding is that that's not always in control of the driver. Like that just kind of, those rear wings will just open at certain point. I mean, I don't think that's very cool either. Like the driver needs to be in control of the car and what they're feeling. And anyway, who am I? I am just somebody on the sidelines that loves the sport, that's got no technical knowledge at all. But it just feels like that the drivers are going to be the one in control of the car, not the car doing things that the driver can't control. So let's hope that the FIA fixes it with the teams.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. Now, speaking of Australian drivers, we touched on Daniel Ricciardo before. You've worked with Mark Webber as well at Silverstone.
Yes, Mark Webber was, and Anne Neal, his wife. They were big supporters of mine, just in terms of providing me access when I was just coming into the sport. So they would give me interviews all the time to be able to chat with him. And yeah, I was at Silverstone in 2013 when he decided to announce his retirement. So that was a big thing for obviously Australian motorsport. He'd been a huge part of our interest in Formula One since 2002. That was fascinating. And he was very magnanimous. He'd made the decision in the previous year and he was happy to be ramping down. I think given his thoughts on the turbo hybrid era, he was happy to have gone at the end of the normally aspirated era. I had a long chat with him and I think he was such a fantastic ambassador for the sport. He's Aussie grit. He lived his dream and he was always about just pushing hard and no BS. And it's great that Daniel Ricciardo replaced him at Red Bull, because that was a nice sort of changing of the guard for us in Australia to have an equally gregarious driver who knew how to spin a soundbite and fly the flag for Australia.
Yeah, and then now we've got Oscar, of course, who's a totally different personality. And I've got to admit, it took me ages to warm to Oscar, only because he was the one that replace Daniel Ricciardo, who, you know, he's from Western Australia. I was Daniel's biggest cheerleader. You know, my butcher had all the newspaper clippings of Daniel Ricciardo up on his wall, on their wall, you know, that old Italian butcher. They've closed down now, which is unfortunate. But yeah, it was sad to see, you know, like Daniel be ousted from McLaren and then, you know, Oscar coming in, and just the whole way that happened with Alpine as well. I did really admire how Oscar handled himself there and just put out that statement and then said nothing, like just sort of, you know, kept his dignity, I suppose, and didn't feed into the whole frenzy of what was going on. So I think that was absolutely the right move there by Oscar, just because he is a lot more close. It did take me quite a while to warm up to him, but now I just think I love his sense of humour. I love how he races. Like, I love watching him race. Yeah. What's he like to interview? Because, you know, what we see through social media, et cetera, you know, this very deadpan, very calm, very almost monosyllabic.
He's exactly the same.
Oh, really?
He's exactly the same. Yeah, he's exactly the same. Very dry sense of humour. And, yeah, I think he's keen to Yeah, give a full answer. Maybe if he obviously can't say what he really wants to say. He's certainly comfortable in the seat. He's established. He's a multiple Grand Prix winner. Yeah. He's definitely different, as you say, to Ricciardo, but he's unbelievably competitive. He's searing speed behind the wheel and he's unflappable. He's not scared of Verstappen. Watching him go toe-to-toe with Verstappen in Jeddah last year was just amazing. You know? So I think it's different. It's all about the competition. And so that's where the angle changes from being more of a sort of a lifestyle thing to looking at his charge for a championship, which obviously last year was tough, but I'm sure he'll get another shot at it.
The Andrea Stella rumour of going to Ferrari, what's your take on that?
Obviously, he came from Ferrari, but I don't buy into it. I think they're just bolstering their team. Obviously, Gianpiero Lambiassi is coming across in 2028 and taking some of his responsibilities that he's already doing off him. I think that's just a rumor at this stage, but look, I could be proved wrong. But look, Ferrari, certainly they need stability. They need to build up their armaments. They've been competitive. They're not quite at the front running stage yet. But yeah, I haven't bought into that as yet. But yeah, I think what a bombshell move for GP to move from Red Bull. I mean, that team just continues to be gutted left, right, and center. And, you know, the talents that have gone, everyone from Christian Horner, Adrian Newey, Will Courtney, Rob Marshall, who will be obviously joining GP along with Will. Jonathan Wintley too, exactly. You know, you've got to say that basically Max's house is falling down around him, but they're still a very strong team and they're a very capable, energetic force. So we'll see what happens.
And Hannah Schmidt as well. I saw a rumor she was leaving Red Bull as well, as Hannah the strategist, and going to, oh gosh, can't remember what I saw, but it was that Hannah was leaving Red Bull. But again, rumors. But like they say, there's no smoke without fire. So let's just see what happens. But you're right, it does feel like Red Bull is imploding.
A number of the staff on their contract, that is, I think if Christian Horner was not with the team any longer, they were able to walk. I think that was a factor in those moves as well. But able to walk out and go for a bigger deal. Lots of teams are wanting to capitalize.
And so you started working Formula One 20 years ago. Lewis Hamilton has been in Formula One for 20 years. Do you think he'll get his eighth title?
It all depends on Ferrari, doesn't it? It's, you know, the last year was abysmal. He looked lost. And it's also tough for Charles Leclerc because he's been there since 2019, I think it is. They haven't won a world championship since 2008. So Lewis has definitely got the wherewithal. I mean, look, he's said over and over again that the cultural difference between British team and the Italian team. And you can imagine that the Italian workforce is very, not stuck in their ways, but they've do things a certain way. And we've seen moves from the top about, from John Elkann saying the drivers should be talking less and focusing on the driving less, which doesn't really motivate drivers, does it? Hamilton said this year when they were testing at Fiorano at their shakedown that he felt like everyone was together on a more united front. We'll see. But look, they've been running close to Mercedes. If they can add it up, they're bringing up a big upgrade to Miami. So we'll see what happens. At this stage, it looks like Mercedes is going to continue winning, and that's not the way you win a world championship. But if he signs a new contract, which we expect he'll sign another deal after this, that likely will be his last contract extension in Formula One, then, and Ferrari continue on its path, then, you know, anything's possible in 2027.
Yeah, anything's possible, I suppose. They might get Hannah Schmidt. They might get Andrea Stella, and who knows what the future holds. My respect for Lewis is, you know, I would love to see him take an eighth. And with Ferrari, that would be a dream. So, you know, being Italian, my blood is Ferrari red. I don't have a choice. So.
No, that's okay. It would be massive box office for him to win an eighth world title. He's just fantastic, even from a press point of view. He gives you a completely full answer. He's honest. I remember when he was having a bit of there was issues with the FIA president, Mohammed Ben Salah, and the swearing ban, lots of stuff. And Lewis, you know, I think it was, you know, does Mohammed Ben Salah have your support? And he just, in the chat, he was like, I've never supported him. He's very open and honest. He doesn't pull back and he says what he thinks, exactly like Max, because they're world champions and they're not worried about their role. You know, I mean, obviously they're not going to be eviscerating their team, but they can speak openly. And it would just be the biggest box office. And look, records are there to be broken. Michael Schumacher was and he is an incredible guy. Just to watch him out on track was magic. Coming out of the pits, his first lap would just be absolutely on the ragged edge, and just the way he rallied his team around him, never a negative word, just a combatant till the end. He'll always be considered one of the top drivers and one of the all-time greats. So he's never going to lose that, whether or not he keeps his seven or not.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I agree. Oh, fabulous. Now, Lance Stroll and Leighton Hewitt, is that story in the book?
It's not. But Lance Stroll's a very interesting guy. I mean, even the way he's come in, he's a very sort of misunderstood driver. I don't know whether he's have you had much to do with Lance?
No, I haven't had anything to do with Lance, but I did interview on the podcast Annie Bradshaw, who worked with Lance Stroll, helping him with his public image. I've got to say that when he broke his wrist or his arm and then carried on racing, like I think a couple of weeks later, and even Fernando Alonso came out and just said, look, this guy's a champ, like to be able to do a Grand Prix while he's in so much pain, etc. I suppose my perception of Lance changed then. Like, well, if he really was like, sitting in the seat being a little daddy's boy, he wouldn't have done that. He would have just let the reserve driver come in saying, you know, perfect excuse, I've got a broken wrist, but he wanted to keep racing. Yeah, I guess it's always going to be hard for someone like him with your dad owning the team. Tell us about your experience with Lance.
I think I've seen him throughout his career. And yeah, I agree with you. Seeing him come back from that injury was incredible. And when we heard him speak about that recovery process, he was passionate. He was excited. Well, he was excited to get back into the car and he was wanting to race. And that's what we want to see out of him. I think he's been jaded a little bit throughout his career. I spoke to him on the eve of his Williams drive and he was very earnest. He spoke very openly about his career. Yeah, he was certainly just like any other driver, just very open and honest. But as he's gone on, he's shied away from the press. It's been very difficult to get to him. And yeah, I was doing a piece for the Toronto Star and he didn't want to speak to us. So the team provided some answers that instead of anything like that. It's very tough. But I mean, on the lighter side, that chat, the talk about Lance and Leighton Hewitt, the pandemic season started with, so 2020 started with obviously Australia, and there was like a hit to hit between him and Leighton Hewitt. And it turns out that
playing tennis.
Yes, at Melbourne Park, and actually one of the practice courts at Melbourne Park. And he apparently had called up the Grand Prix organizers and said, I'm a huge tennis fan. Can you get me a hit with Leighton Hewitt? And so
he asked for that publicity kind of opportunity, did he?
Yes. One of the Grand Prix organizers who said, oh, let's get Lance Stroll and who's a good Aussie tennis player? Oh, Leighton Hewitt. No, he'd gone out, asked for it. And you could tell on the court, he was having a hit with his idol. It was amazing to watch. And yeah, he was full of beans that day. So it's good to see. That's what we want to see from Lance. We want to see someone who's passionate. We want to see any Grand Prix driver who has risen to the ranks of being one of the 22 elite. We want to see them really excited to be there, pushing like hell to get results. I mean, we've seen flashes of it through Lance's career, but yeah, definitely want to see more of it.
Yeah, be good for him to, you know, get a couple of good results that he can be really proud of. Yeah, it's a team on Struggle Street this season at the moment. Let's hope that can turn around for them.
Yeah, even seeing just Adrian Newey in the press conference, not the official one, in the Aston Martin stat on Thursday, there was like a media scrum at the Aston Martin hospitality enclosure at Albert Park, and seeing Newey and the bosses of Honda Racing Corporation, Koji Watanabe, they were just ashen-faced and so embarrassed of what was going on. And just hearing Adrian talk about the fact that the drivers could only withstand a certain amount of laps before, you know, the vibrations would threaten permanent nerve damage in their hands. It was just amazing.
Oh my God. I mean, that's, if you were Lance Stroll or, you know, Fernando Alonso, I mean, would you even get in the car to do a race? Oh, it's crazy. That's
fallen on drivers for you, isn't it? If they have a crash like Alonso crashing, having the barrel roll crash at Australia, I think it was 2016 or 2018, something like that. And yeah, he got out, and if he could have, he would have taken the restart. He wasn't allowed to, but they're born to race, bred to race.
Yeah. And that's all they want to do. Like you said before, they're just competitive beasts, and it doesn't matter what they're doing, that they just want to win. I remember hearing Fernando saying that there were some sports that he wouldn't participate in because he knows he can't win. So he doesn't want to play, like, want to be, you know, paddle, you know, that the other drivers play, which I think is hilarious. Well, Stuart Bell, let's dive into the final three, shall we? So these are the three questions that we ask all of the guests that come on the podcast. Stuart, if you could go to any Grand Prix race, whether it's on the current calendar or a former calendar, which race would you like to go to and why?
It will be Brazil every time, simply because the track into Lagos is, you know, you can feel the ghost of the past there, seeing the cars. From the back of the paddock, you can see 80% of the track. Brazil is a fantastic place to visit. I loved Rio and just the weather, the people, the food, the Brazilian steakhouses, the churrascarias, and it's just a fantastic place. But that track actually is just dynamite. And if you're feeling like F1's bleeding out of your soul a bit, you want to get that back, go to Brazil.
Yeah, I've been to Brazil a couple of times traveling, and I went to the FIFA World Cup there, and just being surrounded by those crazy passionate Brazilian football fans was next level. It's a wonderful country. I totally agree. And yeah, I shiver a little bit thinking of the meat sweats that I got from steakhouses. Yeah. If you could go to any Formula One destination for a holiday, so on a non-race weekend, just to go somewhere to enjoy the place, which Formula One destination would you choose to go to for a holiday and why?
I think it's Japan. I lived there in 2004 and yeah, just love the place. It's just the history, the people, the food. You can explore it from top to bottom, from Hokkaido all the way down to Okinawa, and it's just, yeah, it's an incredible place. And the Japanese are just so friendly and kind. And the exchange rate's also very favorable at this point in time. So that would be,
Probably wouldn't have been though back then when you were living there, because Japan used to be an expensive place for Australians to go to years back.
Yeah, I think it was about 70 cents or something like that, 70 yen for...
What were you doing there? Like, what made you move to Japan?
I was teaching English.
Oh, you're teaching English.
Yeah,
wow.
That's when you can make money teaching English. Yes. You could do a part-time role, so you could do 5 hours of work a day and still earn a good wage. And so, yeah, we would go out and explore. We had bicycles that we would ride along, and just you could explore. We were living in Tokyo, so there was endless entertainment. It was just a beautiful place. And you would ride your bike to the station, and they had all these bike sheds that were manned by old guys. And so you would ride in, and the old guy, hello, and you'd just be so happy. They'd be like, where are you going today? And I'm going to Disneyland. They'd be like, whoa. And it's just, the Japanese people are so, I'm positive, they're positive. It's just it's a great place. And there's lots of places where you can go to onsens and relax and get the resort feel and all that sort of stuff. So that's definitely my answer.
Good answer. Good answer. Now, if you could holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would you choose to go on a holiday with and why?
I think if you want to go on holiday with someone, you want someone who's pretty relaxed. So I would go Valtteri Bottas. When he first came into Formula One, he was still pretty intense, and you could see the fire in his eyes. He was really very motivated and ready to grab some results. But I think, yeah, now seeing how relaxed he is, and he can have a laugh, he's great. Just even just the interview, he's the ultimate. You can talk to him about travel, and I've interviewed him about travel for different publications, and just the way he likes to do things, very relaxed. He'd be a very easy companion to go to wherever with, Bottas is for sure.
Yeah, he's got a fantastic sense of humour. I think he'd make a great travel companion. You know, he could get up early and go cycling and then, you know, come back and make you a good coffee. So that's...
I'm all about that.
Terrific. Oh, Stuart Bell, I could sit here and talk to you all day about Formula One, and we're out of time, unfortunately, but thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Don't forget, you can buy Stuart's book. It's out now, Formula One, The World's Most Brutal Sport. You can get it from Amazon and a bunch of other booksellers. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. If you've liked what you've listened to, please rate and review the show. If you're watching on YouTube, hello, thanks very much. And we'd love you to subscribe. You know, the stats show that only about 10% of people who watch this on YouTube actually subscribe. So please hit that subscribe button, because it really does help this small podcast grow. which is the name of the game. You can find us on all the social media platforms as well. And if you'd like to drop us an email, it's hello@awaywegopodcast.com. Stuart Bell, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much. And thank you guys for having us in your ears. Until next week and until lights out.
Are you ready?
And it's lights out and away we go.
Away We Go Podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto.